Hello and welcome to The Wire, your independent national coverage of current affairs right across Australia on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Amina Shakur, coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. And today on the show...
She obviously enjoys the notoriety, she enjoys the controversy, she likes to stir the pot. That's what populist politicians do.
Pauline Hanson suspended from Senate following burqa incident.
They're calling the social workers early intervention officers, and the idea is that they work in the schools and help teachers.
Victoria to place social workers in schools to prevent youth crime. And later today...
We managed to survive a pretty rough period of time, and in the meantime, launch CTV Plus.
Channel 31 receives a federal funding boost. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. One Nation Senator Pauline Hanson has been suspended from Senate for 7 days after wearing a burqa in Parliament to push for its ban, a bill which has been long campaigned for. Fellow senators including Mehreen Farooqi and Fatima Payman have condemned the incident as racist and disrespectful to Muslim Australians. Maeve Groom asked Associate Professor Paul Williams, a political commentator at Griffith University, if the suspension was fair and appropriate, considering Senator Hanson's actions.
Yeah, look, I do see it as fair and appropriate. It clearly is a breach of Senate rules. So, you know, strategically or logistically, it was in breach. But also rhetorically, I think it was inappropriate for the Senate chamber. And even politically, in terms of what Senator Hanson expects to get from it, I think is something of a misfire. So I'm not seeing the same sort of traction in the hours and days after she's done it that she got when she did it back in 2017. Obviously, that really fired up her base. I'm not seeing the same sort of response. And I think that Pauline Hanson's probably overshot the mark here, simply because this is really not what Australians are focused on at the moment. You know, 2017, this is pre-COVID. Many Australians were still fighting the culture wars. It seems that so much of Pauline Hanson's own base has moved on. So much of Pauline Hanson's base is worried about housing security, even food security with the cost of living. You know, I think it's appropriate that the Senate have condemned her for this. So she's got a censure and she's got a suspension, which is probably the toughest sanction.
Could this incident further shift public opinion or encourage further support for One Nation, particularly in the political climate we currently live in?
The reason she did it, obviously, was to capitalise on her growing support. One Nation has waxed and waned over the years in terms of support. When she did it in 2017, she was facing a possibility of becoming an irrelevancy, and then her popularity spiked again because everyone started talking about Pauline Hanson. So she obviously enjoys the notoriety. She enjoys the controversy. She likes to stir the pot. That's what populist politicians do, and that's one of the reasons why Pauline Hanson's maintained her popularity. But again, this is the wrong climate for that. And so what she's trying to do, she knows that she's polling 18% in the polls, both in Queensland and federally, and in some seats, of course, much higher. So if there are a federal election held tomorrow, you know, One Nation might win a few seats on coalition preferences. You know, it's not impossible. But it's really not what Australians are thinking about at the moment. So I suspect that even though she probably wanted to move her vote from 18 to say 25% and therefore overtake the coalition, because the coalition's on about 24% at the moment. But I think a lot of a lot of Australians would see this as A, not very original, because she did this stunt eight years ago, so it's almost like she's rehashing her old act. And B, it's not what Australians are worried about at the moment. You know, we seem to have moved on from the culture wars, and we're talking very much about what we call material politics, not post-material politics. We're worried about housing, we're worried about the cost of living, we're worried about the cost of healthcare, enhanced hospital ramping. In Queensland, we're worried about Olympic infrastructure and education, and as you saw, you know, teachers being on strike and teachers' wages, and those sorts of material politics are much more important for Queenslanders and Australians than whether or not Muslim women should be banned from wearing a burqa in public.
She appears unfazed by the criticism, expressing in a statement on Facebook that Labor and the Greens failed to debate this issue in the Senate, and that the burqa ban is not about religious expression but community safety, women's rights and social cohesion. Does she have any merit to her words, or are other senators such as Mehreen Farooqi and Fatima Payman right to condemn her actions as racist and disrespectful to the Muslim community?
Well, look, I think she's using the women's rights issue as something of a Trojan horse. I mean, I'm not terribly sure that Senator Hanson's first priority is women's rights. I think the subtext of this is still stirring up division and antipathy and fear of a minority religious group in order to galvanise votes. And that's what populists do, both on the left and particularly on the right. We've seen this in the United States. We're seeing it in Britain. We've seen it in Western Europe, that conjuring up fear, trying to divide the community, and trying to blame the people's woes, such as not being able to pay their grocery bills, it's too expensive to go to the doctor, you know, a whole range of things on minorities. And in order to exploit and build their electoral base, we're seeing Nigel Farage do this in Great Britain. And there's no doubt that the surge in One Nation support of late is a perception in the Australian community that neither the two major parties, the Liberal National Coalition or Labor, can fix the housing crisis. They can't fix the cost of living. No one seems to be doing anything about hospital ramping, a whole range of issues that are affecting Australians. So that's why third parties are often a refuge. And that's been exacerbated by a moderate Liberal leadership. So the departure of Peter Dutton has meant a lot of very right-wing, hard-right coalition supporters, particularly in Queensland, have left the coalition to go to Pauline Hanson because they see more of her as her spiritual home. And that's another reason why Barnaby Joyce is contemplating moving to One Nation, because he doesn't see a spiritual home in the coalition anymore. He would probably more identify with One Nation. So in that sense, it's from your point of view, whether you see it as a racist attack or not, but that's clearly the rationale of One Nation. Exploit differences and divisions and fears of the community in order to expand the electoral base. The problem with that strategy is what we're seeing this week, and Pauline Hanson fronting the media and giving a press conference saying, I don't apologise for what I did, I'm standing for what I believe in. Pauline Hanson's base would love to hear that. It would consolidate her base. So the people who already vote One Nation or are inclined to vote One Nation would just be more rusted on and they would cheer her on. Doesn't necessarily bring new voters in from the coalition, and that's the problem that Pauline Hanson faces. And in fact, some of the One Nation voters might actually say, you know what, Pauline, you've been singing this tune for 8 years. What are you doing about housing? What are you doing about the cost of living?
Associate Professor Paul Williams, political commentator at Griffith University, speaking there with Maeve Groom. Across Victoria, schools are about to take on a new role in tackling youth crime. The government is introducing social workers and early intervention officers into classrooms, hoping to spot the warning signs before violence takes hold. The program is designed to identify young people at risk of disengagement and provide support before crime becomes a part of their lives. As Thomas Curtis spoke with Rosemary Sheehan, Professor of Social Work at Monash University, and asked what has been announced by the government with regards to social workers.
The Victorian government announced that it was going to send social workers to 20 of the state schools in Victoria as an attempt to try and reduce violent youth crime. And what it's done is identify some specific schools where there's already children who are drifting towards some crime and antisocial behaviour. And they're calling the social workers early intervention officers, and the idea is that they work in the schools and help teachers and wellbeing coordinators and school nurses to try and identify children who are at most at risk of drifting towards antisocial behaviour, and also to keep an eye on children we would call troubled children, and to try and focus on improving their school attendance and sense of belonging and relationships with peers, and also then attending to children who've been suspended and trying very hard to get them back into mainstream schooling. So that's the intent of the program.
Do you think the government's reasoning behind this decision was because that student wellbeing isn't being looked after by our schools?
No, I don't think that was the rationale. I think the rationale was that children who are already, or young people who are already offending and possibly coming before the courts, are overwhelmingly disengaged from school, disengaged from education, and possibly at odds with families, and possibly not even living with their families. And so the idea was, if you can somehow keep children engaged at school and have what you might call pro-social modelling, where you've got mentors and adults who can show children that being part of a community can actually deliver a better feeling about yourself, then that was probably going to be a more helpful way. I think in the schools, you know, the pupil welfare coordinators in schools, they are already working very hard on child wellbeing in the schools, but they have limited resources. They're often teachers who are carrying a class.
So I'm assuming that's the same with school counsellors. Like, they don't have the sort of resources?
Again, you know, it's a pressured role, and particularly if it's a school where there's a range of challenging behaviours amongst the pupils, it's going to be very tough for the counsellor to, as a solitary person, to try and work with those young people. So unless you have a systems approach, and unless you at the same time as put these workers into the schools, you also are looking at what are the root causes of why children or young people are offending. What's going on in their lives, and how do you then turn them away from offending behaviours? So I think one of the things that the Scots did quite powerfully was to try and reintegrate young people into the community. But any of these innovations have to be based on a partnership model. They can't be just sort of putting one group of professionals in and one person to try and turn things around.
So how does the new initiative sort of differ from the existing student support services like the social workers already in Victorian schools? Is there sort of a difference?
In Victoria we have student support services, but they're area based. So they're not actually located in specific schools. So they work across a range of schools. They have responsibility for a number of schools, and they go in and out of those schools as needed, or to catch up with perhaps student coordinators. But they're not actually specific school-based. That's the Victorian experience. It might be different in New South Wales. But so you've got, you've got a group of social workers, and they might also be psychologists, but they are spread across a number of schools and trying to manage the particular referrals can be quite challenging, and also for the school to perhaps be able to know the workers' capacities if they're not actually based in the school and they've developed a working relationship. That can be quite a challenge on both sides.
Rosemary Sheehan, Professor of Social Work at Monash University, speaking there with The Wire's Thomas Curtis. You're listening to The Wire on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Amini Shakur in Melbourne. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CC 102.1 FM. And to our friends in Noosa on Noosa FM 101.3. And to the other side of the country to Radio Goolaree in Broome, Western Australia. The federal government is providing $386,000 to the community TV sector for strengthening their streaming platform. CTV Plus is an app where all community TV channels will be able to stream their programming as well as on the smart TVs. It comes at a time where community television is facing different digital and financial challenges, and CTV Plus hopes to be a tool for stations to generate revenue and new target audiences. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan asked General Manager of Channel 31 in Victoria, Shane Dunlop, his initial thoughts about the government's funding.
Well, I mean, their investment is far more reaching than that. It's just that CTV Plus is obviously a key part of our future, and I think the government especially recognises that. Their support over the last several years has been instrumental in, you know, making sure that we're still here to be broadcasting, but also in a position to be developing services like CTV Plus to improve our offering and to re-expand across the whole of Australia. But certainly their support, you know, financially to help with the, you know, development of CTV Plus has been great.
Now, for our listeners who are unfamiliar, what's CTV Plus app and what advantages will it bring to community TV?
Yeah, so we launched CTV Plus about 4 years ago as a joint effort between the remaining community television stations. There were only two left in Melbourne and Adelaide, and so we lost the stations in Sydney, Brisbane and Perth some time ago, and that's due to, you know, effectively a decade of poor public policy at a federal level around spectrum allocation for community television broadcasters. We managed to survive a pretty rough period of time. And in the meantime, launched CTV Plus initially as a website. We then launched in 2022 the mobile device apps on Android and iOS. And only earlier this month, officially launched CTV Plus as a service on smart TVs on Google, Apple, and in a few short weeks, Samsung. Effectively, what it is our streaming service that, you know, provides people with an additional way to engage with what we're offering. So right now, you can access both Channel 31 Melbourne, Channel 44 Adelaide's live streams. So you don't have to be within our local area to receive that through your antenna. You can just open the app and you can watch our live broadcasts anywhere in the country. In addition to that, there's roughly 250 community TV programs that are available to watch on demand, and we're adding to that every day. And so what you're basically engaging with is a one-stop shop for community television, and it encapsulates, essentially the entire country's footprint of content creators at a community television level.
Now, how will this support help community TV to become more sustainable?
Well, the support that was announced last December from the federal government effectively relates to a three-year period. So we're in the first year now, and there's two more years of that to come. And that's sort of obviously to support CTV Plus and how that gets rolled out, and perhaps how that's supported to initially be a complementary service alongside our terrestrial broadcasts, but one day may well replace, because obviously audience trends are changing and people are watching less and less free-to-air TV. So CTV Plus is important for us to make sure that we're relevant long-term. But that support from the government was also instrumental in giving us an opportunity to look at how community TV is structured in Australia, how we are best set up to service local communities, and how we can look at effectively reshaping the sector so that we're able to be sustainable well into the future.
What are the other challenges community TV faces as we speak?
Well, some of our challenges are no different to the same challenges that all traditional media face. So across the television and radio media landscape, everybody's having to deal with digital disruption and what that means for audience fragmentation, declining revenue associated to traditional media platforms, all of those existential threats that all traditional media are currently facing. We are certainly facing those same challenges. I suppose in the short term, now that we've launched our streaming service and we're, you know, out there actively promoting it, our short term challenge is getting those who are what are viewers and supporters of community TV to start to embrace the new platform.
As you mentioned, the federal government provided $386,000 for community TV with this announcement. Is this enough?
That's technically just the funding that they've contributed towards the development of CTV Plus up to this point. Now, that is through Community Broadcast Foundation grants. There was a commitment of additional funding as part of MyEFO in December last year that spoke to, you know, supporting the sector to undergo a transformation so that we can be more able to tackle the next 10 years.
General Manager of Channel 31 in Victoria, Shane Dunlop there, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. Santiago Velasquez is an electrical engineer and International Day of People with Disabilities ambassador. Because of his vision impairment, he decided to migrate from Colombia to Australia for better opportunities. He founded a software company called Halo to solve the inaccessibility of public transport. Howard Media's reporter Emma Myers spoke with Santiago Velasquez about the cultural and infrastructural differences regarding disability between Australia and Colombia.
I am originally from Colombia, and I emigrated with my family when I was 12 to Australia, basically looking for better opportunities given my vision impairment. And I've been in Australia, I think next year is going to be 17 years. My disability is basically blindness. I can still see light, colors, and large objects, but details non-existent. So everything that I do is either through Braille or using screen reading software where my computer talks to me, my watch, my phone, and so on and so forth. Braille and or my guide dog helps me get around. Training, I'm an electrical engineer and I run my own company. So I started a software company called Halo because I was frustrated with the inaccessibility of public transport. And I wanted to do something that could help me in a way that benefited anybody. But the short of it is, I was frustrated because I can't see buses approaching, so they would leave me behind. I didn't know when to lift up my hand to wave. And if I managed to get on a bus, I couldn't look at a map. I couldn't press the bell at the right moment, so I had to rely on the driver to remember where I wanted to get off. Basically, what I do is I write software that allows anybody, yourself, myself, to plan a route like you would in Google Maps. But the Halo platform allows you to disclose your disability if you want. So I would put I'm a guide dog user and whatnot. So as you get close to catching a bus, a train, the driver gets an alert on where to stop on their dashboard. And it also shows them what type of access requirements and assistance you might need.
What does International Day of People with Disability mean to you?
For me, it's something quite simple, but also something a little bit hard. And I say that because in one hand, it's recognizing that disability is a benefit to society. Having the same gets boring after a while. But it's also hard because there is still a lot of work that we need to do. And there is a lot of work and it's very complex. And for us to get it right, a lot of parties have to come to the table, both from the public sector as well as the private sector. And that doesn't even include single individuals. So very excited, very happy, and rather very honored to be selected as an ambassador by the Australian government for International Day of Persons with Disabilities. But also it's a massive task, and I hope that with the other ambassadors, we can make a meaningful change and make the general public realize that people with disabilities can do anything. We just tend to do it a little bit differently than everybody else.
And what makes you passionate about disability advocacy?
The biggest thing is just breaking perceptions of people who otherwise would never have thought that people with disabilities could do anything. And one example of that is one time I was at uni and I was picking up a sandwich. I didn't bring any lunch and I was just picking up a sandwich from a coffee shop. And somebody says to me, just randomly, oh, I'm so sorry for the fact that you can't see. And that came out of nowhere, as I'm sure it has come for a lot of people with disabilities. And I stood there and I said, oh, listen, if you have any questions, I'm not sorry about my condition. It's my life. I don't regret it in any way, shape or form. And after 10 minutes of them asking questions and saying, oh, how do you do this? And why aren't you sorry? And why wouldn't you get your vision back? The turnaround of, wow, I was saying that this guy was living a horrible life turned into, wow, this guy is amazing. And I realized that that comes because of my upbringing, because of my particular disability, and because of the supports that I have had. Not everybody will have that, and I'm conscious that some people with disabilities, actually, in fact, a lot of people with disabilities have struggles, big ones, and we need to work very hard to overcome them. But it was just very nice to see people realize I'm blind, and or somebody is in a wheelchair and or somebody might have autism or whatever, but we're all humans.
Electrical engineer and ambassador Santiago Velasquez there speaking with Powered Media's Emma Myers. And unfortunately, that is the end of today's show. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Brisbane. With the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, X and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung people of the Kulin Nations, the traditional custodians of the lands where this program is produced. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. I'm Amini Shakur coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks so much for your company and we'll see you next time on The Wire.